issues that should be of primary concern. The fate of organized human society, even of the survival of the species, depends on this. How much attention is given to these things as compared with, whether Trump lied about something? I think those seem to me the fundamental criticisms of the media.
Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, author, and linguist, now a laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, Tucson. He taught for 50 years at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tune in next week when we continue our conversation with Noam Chomsky about Gaza, Israel's new nationality law, the recent Trump-Putin summit, Iran, North Korea, the war in Yemen, and more. In December, Noam Chomsky will be celebrating his 90th birthday. Oh, and happy birthday to Rob Young here at Democracy Now! And Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer in our New York studio. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godars. I'm Amy Goodman. Get our transcripts at democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and up next is the KBOO Evening News. The KBOO programming that you're listening to is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland. Presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump. Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonian fugitive couple caught after 18 years on the run.
Facebook gives 30-day suspension to conspiracy theorist and InfoWars owner Alex Jones.
U.S. Senate passes cuts on Chinese-made goods. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 27th, 2018. I'm Summer Barraza.
And I'm Lucas Campbell.
We would like to include a content warning for child abuse and extreme violence. An Oregon couple has been caught after 18 years on the lam for child sex abuse crimes. Leon Shaw and Victoria Kravitz were on the run since 2000 before getting caught in Mississippi after a funeral home visit. Kravitz was planning the funeral for her husband, who passed away in a Mississippi hospital from natural causes. Kravitz, who was using the alias Jennifer Larson, decided to use one of Shaw's aliases to make arrangements for a funeral. However, when the mortician had entered the name into their computer, they discovered that the alias entered was one used by Shaw, who was on the FBI's most wanted list. 18 years ago, Shaw and Kravitz were accused of child sex abuse and sodomy. In 1999, victims of the couple came out to the public about their abuse that began initially in 1989. From the couple, even the worry for the current children living with the couple at the time, they would have been sexually abused. Shaw and Kravitz were charged by Klamath law enforcement after an investigation for rape, sodomy, forcing children under the age of 10 to have intercourse, and allowing one of the children to be sexually taken advantage of by an adult. During the investigation, an adult woman had come forward about being abducted by the couple as a minor and forced to give birth to Shaw's son, who she had left behind when she escaped the couple. The fugitive couple preferred quiet, rural areas, making their acts and escape secret. Shaw and Kravitz took on new identities after moving south of Greenville, Mississippi, where they supported themselves on Kravitz's cleaning homes and Shaw's doing woodworking. On Thursday, July 26, Kravitz had visited a courthouse in Jackson, Mississippi, where the court federally charged her with unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Kravitz, who was charged in Mississippi, will now be expected to return back to Oregon.
U.S. Facebook suspends Alex Jones. Late night Thursday, Facebook suspended Alex Jones, the right-wing conspiracy theorist and owner of news publication, InfoWars for Bullying and Hate Speech. Four videos that have since been taken down were judged by Facebook community standards teams to be hate speech content. All four videos have since been removed from Facebook and from YouTube. InfoWars' own Facebook account will remain unaffected, while Alex Jones' personal account will finish its 30-day banishment. Jones' page will continue to be displayed on the platform, but without privileges to post, share, and comment on Facebook until the suspension has cleared. This is Jones' second encounter with Facebook for posting extreme content that violates Facebook's community standards. In addition, Jones will not be allowed to post an administrator on the InfoWars page until his Facebook suspension is completed.
With no debate, the Senate unanimously passed a bill that would cut or eliminate tariffs on toasters, chemicals, and roughly 1,000 other items made outside the United States. Nearly half of those items are made from China, according to Reuters' analysis of government records. The U.S. and China, the world's two largest economies, are increasingly at loggerheads over trade. Independent News said U.S. President Donald Trump has announced a series of punitive tariffs on Chinese imports in a bid to halt a Chinese surge in technology industries that threatens to displace U.S. dominance. China had retaliated with its own duties on imports from the United States. The Independent writes the White House has not publicly taken a position on so-called miscellaneous tariff bill, which has now passed both the Senate and the House of Representatives unanimously. The two chambers need to resolve minor differences before they can send the legislation to Trump to sign into law. Supporters of the bill had said it would boost the economy by getting rid of tariffs set up to protect industries that no longer exist in the United States, said Independent News. The Nation Association of Manufacturers has said U.S. businesses pay $1 million a day on such import duties. Jay Timmons, a trade group president, says it makes no sense because it is a direct and punishing tax on making things in America and for creating jobs in America. Some domestic manufacturers have complained the bill would undercut their business by making it easier for rivals to bring in cheap foreign goods. Michael Korchmar, the head of family-owned travel goods company in Florida, said, "There's no reason to block opportunity U.S. manufacturers might have for rebuilding our manufacturing base." Independent News writes Mr. Korchmar earlier this year planned to hire up to 30 workers in his Naples, Florida factory, but he put those plans on hold after being told by Reuters that the bill would lower tariffs on an insulated food bag that he planned to produce. Mr. Kortchmar said that he may decide to expand production because Democratic Senator Bill Nelson removed that item from the bill. "We've got a good shot, we've got a good bit of time, but we have to reevaluate the market," Mr. Kortchmar said.
Initiative Petition 1, the controversial bill that proposes removing state taxpayer funding for abortions, qualified for the ballot today by a narrow margin. State election workers determined that supporters turned over 117,799 valid signature. That's just 221 above the minimum required to secure a state constitutional amendment on the November ballot. Oregon Life United was the main organizer and relied primarily on volunteers to gather signatures.
As first reported on OregonLife.com, last Wednesday night, a transgender individual who prefers to remain anonymous was harassed and assaulted while walking down the street by a bicycle rider on the 400 block of Northeast Gleason Street named Timothy Emmett Walsh. As Walsh approached, he said to the passerby, "You're a man in a woman's clothing." Walsh then continues to hurl insults about the person's appearance and proceeded to physically attack them in the face multiple times. Portland police arrested Walsh later that night at a Greyhound bus stop station, where he fled onto his bike.
The Portland Tribune first reported last week on the Beaverton Human Rights Advisory Commission taking a stand against Beaverton's ban on overnight car camping on city streets. The commission voted for a resolution on July 11th opposing the ban, and there were no dissenters. The opponents to the ban included Cameron Monfard, who is on the commission while also attending Beaverton High School as a senior. Both he and commission chair Farah Kachi presented the resolution at its July 17th meeting. Monfard said last Friday, "We should not be running homeless people out of our community." Monfard added that the ban might have drawn more support if the houseless had somewhere to go. The commission's resolution points out that Beaverton's severe weather shelter, which has been in operation for winters, prohibits children, forcing people and families in poverty to live in their cars. Kachi said in response to the city council member Lacey Beattie, who was the one dissenter and is the council liaison to the Human Rights Advisory Commission, that "We will continue to advise the mayor and council on the issue until an equitable solution is reached. For a city that can find $46 million in fundraising, it should not be a problem to find a solution to this."
Jackson County Sheriff Marine Deputy could tell one of the paddlers in an open raft clearly wasn't sober. Denton approached the man, who turned out to be South Dakotan, who wasn't shy about admitting he was impaired and was happy to declare he hadn't been drinking. This kid was laughing. "I'm not drunk. I'm stoned on good Oregon weed, and it's legal," Denton says. The Oregonian writes, "When the tourist received a ticket for boating under the influence of intoxicants, he became the latest, but not the last, to learn that legal weed in Oregon isn't a free pass to smoke on the water." "It's legal at home, but you still can't operate a boat," Denton says. "We get a lot of people who maybe aren't specifically here to come to do that, but it's on their agenda. It's become more mainstream. There's definitely more smoke on Southern Oregon rivers now that marijuana has joined beer, wine, and other intoxicants for rafters and other boaters to imbibe during their adventures. Marijuana is becoming as common as a cooler full of beer ever since weed became legal in 2016. Devin Stephenson of Rapid Pleasure Raft Rentals say many rafters don't seem to think twice about sparking up on raft trips. "Everybody seems to think they can do it and get away with it because the cops can't detect it." The Oregonian writes, "Under Oregon boating laws, boaters are allowed to drink alcohol if they are legal to drink, and they also may have open containers. However, they are not allowed to be intoxicated while operating a boat. Boaters follow the same standards as automobile drivers, with those exceeding a 0.8% blood alcohol level considered over the limit. With marijuana, the rules are different. When it's legal to have an open container of alcohol on a boat, it is illegal to smoke pot in public, and Oregon waterways are considered public. You could lose your boating license and get fined for being high while driving a boat, so don't drive your boat stoned or smoke on the water."
"Getting around Portland this weekend will be an exercise in patience," says Oregon Live. Figuring out how to avoid a closed freeway, on-ramp, off-ramp, or even just road this weekend takes concentration. Here's a list of some of the closed routes drivers will experience from Friday night through early Monday. Oregon Live covers that Interstate 84 westbound ramp to northbound Interstate 5 will be closed through August 6th for construction. It closed Wednesday night, and other than the police issue on Thursday morning, it doesn't seem to be causing any delays to those who are rejoining I-5 north using I-405 northbound. All on-ramps to I-84 westbound along the Bingfield from 82nd westward are closed during the work on the ramp to I-5 north. This weekend, I-5 northbound will close from the I-84 eastbound ramp to the Fremont Bridge for paving. The closure is in place 10 p.m. Friday, July 27th through 5 a.m. Monday, July 30th, and repeats next weekend. Four on-ramps to northbound I-5 will be closed at the same time. Westbound Morrison Bridge Ramp, eastbound Morrison Bridge Ramp, North Williams on-ramp near North Broadway, Southwest 5th Avenue ramp to I-405. In general, most of the overflow traffic should be directed onto I-405 northbound during the weekend. It's best to choose an alternate route or avoid the downtown core when possible.
Next, on Climate Connections, a baseball team embraces solar power.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Before a baseball game at Chase Field in Phoenix, Arizona, Diamondback fans mill around the stadium entrance. An open-air pavilion topped with solar panels provides relief from the blazing sun.
We're able to use the solar pavilion as a way to create some shade on that high-traffic part of the ballpark, but then also take advantage of the solar output that we put back on the grid.
Graham Rossini is the Diamondbacks' Vice President of Special Projects and Fan Experience. He says the 17,000-square-foot pavilion is just one way the team is working to promote sustainability. The Diamondbacks have also installed low-flow sinks and toilets, LED concourse lights, and electric vehicle charging stations. Grease from concessions is recycled into biodegradable diesel fuel. Rossini says stadiums can model environmental behavior for fans who may not have thought much about sustainability.
They can take cues from the ballpark and hopefully incorporate some of that behavior back into their own day-to-day lives.
And he says the team's initiatives can inspire other companies to adopt eco-friendly practices.
We really want to get out in front and help influence other businesses or the other sports teams in our market to say, let's kind of lock arms and go down this road together.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dictated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A handful of barriers restrict Native Americans from gaining equal access to the voting booth, according to Native leaders who are asking federal lawmakers to help them address the issue. Matt Laszlo has a story from Washington.
For Senator Tom Udall, vice chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee, voting barriers and their effects hit close to home. His grandfather overruled a court ruling in Arizona, in turn granting Native Americans the right to vote.
He said in his opinion, which I think is kind of instructive on the topic here today, in a democracy, suffrage is the most basic civil right, since its exercise is the chief means whereby other rights may be safeguarded. To deny the right to vote is to do violence to the principles of freedom and equality.
Despite the progress that's been made, Udall says more needs to be done to address barriers to voting presented by having some hard-to-reach polling locations, ballot translation difficulties, and the lingering problem of low voter turnout. Lieutenant Governor Jefferson Keel of the Chickasaw Nation and the president of the National Congress of the American Indians says investments in technology are key for Indian country.
Electronic or broadband access to these local areas in Indian country would greatly enhance the participation.
Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota says there's also a need to build trust between the federal government and states and tribal governments.
Why should we have to sue in North Dakota every year to get voting rights for Native people?
But with the November midterms approaching, there isn't much time to implement the reforms that tribal leaders continue to call for. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
In other Native vote news, a Navajo man recently registered dozens of Navajo citizens who live in the Phoenix, Arizona area to vote in the upcoming Navajo Nation election, which includes the race for president. Chris Beecher became certified by the tribe's election administration after hearing from the urban Navajo community on social media about challenges to voting in tribal elections, including not being able to travel to the reservation during the weekday to register. Beecher held a two-hour voter registration drive at a Valley Mall last weekend where he says the turnout was constant.
There's a lot of urban Navajo, not just in Phoenix, but also in Albuquerque and Denver and Salt Lake and those urban centers where we typically find a lot of our people. There's a want and a need to register to vote. I think one of the side benefits is that when we register people to vote, we can encourage them to come out to the polls and also vote in not only Navajo elections, but state elections, county elections, and federal elections.
People still need to go to their Navajo chapter to vote or request an absentee ballot. Beecher says there's a lesson from his effort to register voters.
What we need to do as community leaders and as elected leaders is to make sure that we make that process as easy as possible, because a good turnout for Navajo Nation gives us the voice to all these other avenues. And so when people show up to vote, especially in my district that I know of, the Congressional District 1, we have a gigantic impact on how elections turn out based on whether Navajos show up to vote or not. And I'm sure that that's the case in other elections.
Navajo voter registration closes Monday. The primary is in August and the general election in November. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is moving ahead with an environmental review of the proposed pebble mine in Alaska, despite the governor's concerns. Governor Bill Walker, in a letter, questioned whether the gold and copper mine is financially viable or realistic. Army Corps Program Manager Shane McCoy told reporters Thursday the company's financial situation is not part of the agency's review.
We don't really have any opinions on their financial status. We presume that they have the resources available to continue the process until such time they tell us they don't.
Pebble Limited Partnership has failed to recruit investors after their original partner pulled out. Tribal groups opposing the project are concerned the process is being rushed. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, at 10 p.m., it will be 80 degrees in Portland. In the Dalles, 84 degrees. And in Hood River, 82. Today in history, the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon, was recommended to be impeached by the House Judiciary Committee in 1974 for the Watergate scandal. The quote of the day is from Charlotte Whitten, the first woman to be a mayor of a large city in Canada. We all have ability. The difference is how you use it.
Next is your Labor History Smackdown from your host, Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day Miners President Ginger Goodwin was shot dead in British Columbia. His murder sparked Canada's first general strike in Vancouver the following week. Goodwin had arrived in British Columbia 8 years earlier and found work in the Cumberland Mines on Vancouver Island. He considered working conditions in the mines absolutely appalling and began advocating for safety and organizing miners. He was soon blacklisted after participating in a 2-year coal miner strike for recognition on the island. He moved to Trail, British Columbia, where he emerged as a Socialist Party candidate in the 1916 election. He was also elected president of the International Union of Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers District 6, the vice president of British Columbia's Federation of Labor, and the head of the local Trades and Labor Council. He openly expressed his opposition to Canada's entry into the war, stating that workers were now employed in killing each other. He was found unfit for military duty after a medical exam. That was until he led a strike for the 8-hour day at Consolidated Mining and Smelting. It was the world's largest lead and zinc smelter and a key munitions producer during the war. His status was quickly changed to make him eligible for conscription. He fled to the Cumberland Hills, where he hid out for months to avoid the draft. And on this day, Goodwin was shot dead by a Dominion Police special constable. He was brought back to Cumberland, where thousands turned out for his funeral in a mile-long procession. The Vancouver labor movement was outraged by Goodwin's murder and called a one-day general strike on August 2nd to protest his killing.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
We'd like to issue a content warning for assault in the following story. Last week, Tuesday, July 17th, Deeka Dahir Nur, a young Somali girl, died from complications during a female circumcision procedure. Her mother took her to. Somalia is now choosing to prosecute against female genital mutation. Mahdi Muhammad Gould, the deputy prime minister of Somalia, said, "This is an historic moment for ending FGM in Somalia. This cannot be happening in our country in the 21st century. It is not part of our religion, and it will not be part of our culture." The young girl's case would also be an example and rigged message showing that FGM is not accepted includes Gould. A doctor who has operated on the young girl, attempting to save her life, said that Deeka suffered through a type 4 FGM, which is very extreme. The girl also suffered from tetanus and was bleeding and convulsing. Her whole female genital tract had been removed. The labia and the clitoris had been cut off. It's a type 4 FGM, quotes CNN.com. Currently, there are no laws or legislation against FGM in Somalia, which allows for the Somali government to take swift action to implement laws now, as Somalia has the highest rates of FGM in the entire world, where girls between the ages of 15 and 49 have went to a cutter for the procedure. FGM is seen sometimes as a tradition or religious practice, even with the results of the procedures being infertility, infections, bleeding, and labor complications.
Sombra, a Colombian canine drug-sniffing dog, now has a 70,000 bounty placed on her head by the Urabanos, a powerful criminal group. The 6-year-old German Shepherd is a favorite amongst the children and adults of Colombia, but not the Urabanos Mafia, as she has led officers to seize 9 tons of the gang's cocaine. Because of this, Sombra, the winner of 2 canine medals of courage, has been transferred to the El Dorado Airport and is to be escorted by not only her handler, but by a group of officers.
Sky watchers are being treated to the longest blood moon eclipse of the 21st century. From a report, as it rises during the total eclipse, Earth's natural satellite turns into a striking shade of red or ruddy brown. The totality period, when the light from the moon is obscured, will last for 1 hour 43 minutes. Part of the eclipse is visible from Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Australia, most of Asia, and South America. On the same night and over the coming days, Mars will be the closest point to Earth since 2003. Today was a beautiful history-making day in the galaxy. You can watch the live videos of the lunar eclipse online at the NASA YouTube channel.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell and Summer Barraza, me. The producer, engineer, and KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Summer Barraza.
And I'm Lucas Campbell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on More Talk Radio, Cecile and Celeste takes your calls. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein hears from environmental writer and biologist Sandra Steingraber about fracking and climate change. And at 11, on the Ground Radio, spends the hour with writer and activist Makhna Temba, who discusses Russia phobia, police brutality, the kidnapping of immigrants.